saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of bagged concrete and mortar mixes, great for any project. Whether you're pouring a walkway, a concrete slab, or setting a post, view our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
Live on air, presented by Ger Sweeney.
Good evening and welcome. Nice to have your company on this Monday evening. I know things are not exactly as we would like them to be, but I do hope that you're making the most of it, and I hope that you're enjoying the information that you're getting here on Talk Radio Europe. You do know that we strive on a daily and hourly basis to keep you up to date with what's happening. Anyway, for the next hour or so, I hope to keep you entertained. As always, if you'd like to get in contact with the programme, you can do so by email ger, at tre.radio is the best way to do. Now, in the promo that has been running for the last few days here on the radio station, I did say to you that we'd have the famous Irish birthday. Well, we won't. The interview that I did with Mike Murphy, and anybody that knows anything about broadcasting in Ireland knows that Mike Murphy is a broadcasting legend, and I was absolutely delighted to get the opportunity to talk to him. It came about because he is the voice of a new podcast by the Senior Times, which is a magazine distributed in Ireland, but they also have a connection in Fuengirola here in Spain, and you'll find out a little bit more about that later on. But I got the opportunity to talk to Mike, and we pre-recorded the interview late last week, and we just kept chatting and chatting and chatting, and I didn't want to destroy it by editing it down too much. So it's a fairly extensive interview, and you will hear that in the second part of the program, which is coming up very shortly. Ben will be with us as well from Ireland to tell us exactly what's happening. As you know, I travelled home just over 10 days ago, and I've almost got my 2-week isolation period done, but as it stands, we're told to isolate at home anyway and stay at home, and you probably know all that. We'll hear more about that from Ben shortly, but at least we can get out somewhat, unlike the people in Spain at the moment. Anyway, so we're not doing the Irish birthdays because they'll take too long, and I need to keep that free time to talk to Ben. So let's have the number one song in Ireland on this very day back in 1973. Have you any clue what it might be? No. Well, here it is.
Your feet.
Bright Sound of Gilbert O'Sullivan. It was number one on this very day in Ireland back in 1973. Gilbert O'Sullivan from Waterford, of course. That's a song that's called Get Down. All right, going to do a very quick break. Come back to me just after that, and I will be in conversation with Mike Murphy, the broadcasting legend.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney.
It's not often that you get an opportunity to talk to one of Ireland's broadcasting legends, but I'm glad to say that today I have that very opportunity and delighted to welcome Mike Murphy to the programme. Mike, it's lovely to talk to you. How are you?
Good. I'm very well, Jared. Thank you for your very generous introduction. When you hear words like legend, you know you're kind of nearing the end or something like that.
Yeah.
Thank you anyway.
When you get lifetime achievement awards and all
That's
sorts
right.
of stuff,
yeah. You know the blinds are being drawn.
Mike, I don't think you could open your mouth anywhere, but you have a very distinctive voice, and it's one that's recognised and loved and liked across the country and indeed farther beyond as well. You still sound the same, to me anyway, as you did 40, 50 years ago. What's the secret?
Are you sure that's not just you? Are you sure it's not that you're getting old, sir?
Would you believe I was looking at some footage of various programs that you did down through the years on television a little earlier on, and listen, maybe it's me, but you do sound exactly the same. We'll talk about those programs very shortly. You've been in broadcasting since the mid-1960s, Mike, is it?
In fact, even earlier than the mid-1960s, right. Really, you could say at the beginning of the 60s, I kind of drifted into broadcasting, really. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and we were talking about the different approaches that some of my fellow broadcasters have had, and myself. I look at people like Gay, God rest poor Gay, my great old friend, and the Pat Kenny, Brendan Bab, so many of them, that Dave Fanning, you know, all these were all career broadcasters. Mm. You know, they all grew up wanting to be broadcasters, whereas I didn't. I had no, and absolutely no idea what I wanted to be. And in any case, because I failed all my exams in school, there were very few options open to me. So I kind of drifted into doing a bit of acting.
Right.
But then I was going to get married, and I had no job. And basically, I had already now experienced producing sponsored programs, because I was in the Brendan Smith Academy of Acting.
Right.
Brendan at the time was also producing sponsored radio programs. And the man he had in charge of that, no, he was only producing about three programs on Radio Éireann, as it was. And the man in charge was Adrian Cronin. And Adrian later, of course, became the producer of The Late Late Show.
Yes.
But RTE were opening up, and they offered Adrian a job. And so he gave up radio publicity, and I kind of inherited it. And suddenly I was writing scripts. Now, God knows the scripts weren't very complicated for sponsored programs, and selecting the records. So I kind of drifted into it. At the time, RTE then offered me a job as a technician, as a trainee producer.
Right.
And I told them that I had no interest in knobs and buttons and things like that. And I turned it down. But then, you know, within the next 2 years, I was going to get married and I had no job. I was just doing this in the sponsored programs and a little bit of acting, but sure, I was only earning buttons.
Yeah.
And I applied to RTE for an announcer job. And I cheated and said that I had me leaving. But of course, I hadn't got me leaving at all.
Right.
But they never checked it. And ultimately, I got in. After a lot of struggles with the Irish language and various things, I got in.
You were a sports announcer at one point as well, were you?
I was, yeah, I was. And that was terrific. I became a sports announcer by accident. I was out in the RTE TV building, and I was walking through reception, and I knew Tim O'Connor, who was the assistant head of sports. I think Michael O'Hare was the head of sports at the time.
Right,
he was,
okay.
Actually. And Tim said to me, are you busy at the moment? I said, no, I'm only delivering something out here. And he said, listen, we're doing auditions for the sports department. And he said, would you be interested for the TV? And I said, yeah, I would, yeah. He said, well, what you'd have to do is, could you talk off the cuff for 4 minutes about some subject to do with sports?
Right.
I was a rugby player. I used to play rugby. And of course, I was vitally interested in rugby. And the Irish team had been picked that day. So of course, I said, God, I'll have a go at that. And I went in and had no bother. I could do 4 minutes, no problem whatsoever, discussing the Irish team. So, and I got a job presenting in the sports department, yes.
Isn't it amazing when you listen to people talk about their careers, particularly in broadcasting and the world of entertainment, it's about being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
It might be by accident, but that's how it all begins.
You're absolutely right. And I mean, as regards sports, I think the sports was more or less the first thing I did on television. And actually, funnily enough, I did that for a number of years, sports, and I really, really enjoyed it. And then Tom McGrath, who was the doyen of broadcasting, Tom was in the head of Light Entertainment. Mm-hmm. He was the guy. He picked Gay to do the Late Late Show. He picked Brendan O'Reilly to do something else. And I got a call one day that Tom McGrath would like to see me.
Right.
He was up in the St. Francis Xavier Hall and he was rehearsing for the National Song Contest. Now, at that time, remember the National Song Contest, we're talking about 1967, 68, or maybe a little bit later. I'm not quite sure of the dates. But anyway, this was a big deal. And I didn't know Tom McGrath or anything like that. And I walked in and he came back to me and said, how are you, Ed?
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you something. Yes, would you be interested in comparing the National Song Contest? So I said, yeah, I would, yeah. And he said, okay, I'll see you at 4 o'clock on Tuesday. So I remember going outside the Francis Xavier Hall, and I remember kind of leaping in the air because I knew this is the really big break in anybody's career. And it turned out to be. And I did the National Song Contest, and I seem to have done it okay, and it went on from there.
You did, that's right. And I had forgotten about it. The Castlebar Song Contest was where a song was chosen, and was that the one that went forward for the Eurovision, or am I mixing up the Castlebar and the National Song Contest?
No, you are.
I am, okay.
I did have the pleasure of comparing the Castlebar Song Contest for many years.
Right.
I had great fun over there. I loved going over to Castlebar, but no, there was no connection between the two. And and the National Song Contest had, say, 8 songs, and then the public voted on the 8 songs, and then one of them went to Europe. And many years I was the commentator at the Eurovision, so it was
That's
great.
Right.
I was there. I was the commentator, by the way, the night that ABBA won.
Really?
And it was a great night, you know, it really was terrific. I thought ABBA were fantastic. We all did, but I didn't think they were going to go on to be what they became. But it was good fun.
It was fantastic, I would imagine, being there. Now, you would have been commentating on the Eurovision Song Contest. Were you alongside Terry Wogan in those days?
Ah, yeah, but sure, Terry and I, you see, were great friends and had been for many years. When I eventually was allowed in as an announcer, Terry was the senior announcer and I was the junior announcer.
Okay.
At that time, the senior announcers would do a refresher one day of the week with the juniors.
Right.
So it'd be kind of go over all your announcements and teach you and train you and all that kind of stuff. And Terry would always pick himself to go with me. And he and I, every time there was a refresher, he and I, and he'd say to me, we're on for tomorrow, he said. And I'd say, yeah. He said, I'll meet you at 10 o'clock on the first tee in Edmundstown. And I'd say, right. So we'd go out, we'd meet on the first tee. And this is when the two of us were only starting to play golf. And then he'd say to me, is there anything bothering you? And I'd say, no. He said, right, I'll play you for a pound.
Yeah.
So and off we'd go playing golf for the entire day.
Are you a keen golfer, Mike, still?
Yeah, I've been. Unfortunately, I've had a back problem this year. And it has kind of, it's been pretty miserable, actually. I've had a number of operations. But, yes, I am. And I've been playing kind of ever since then, since with Terry. And I play, and we spend time in America, and I play over there. And I've been a member of Royal Dublin for many years. I gave it up this year because I just don't get time to play, and I don't enjoy playing in the bad weather.
No. Along with the Eurovision Song Contest, there would have been a nice bit of travel with that, but you did 2 television series as well down through the years. You did Murphy's America, which I can remember vividly, and I can't really remember Murphy's Australia. I must have been busy in the early 80s, but you got awards for those programmes.
At that time, the Jacobs Awards were much sought after, and every year they were given out, and they were big time in terms of in one's broadcasting career. It was a decided honour to be given a Jacobs Award.
Mm.
I remember Gay got 6 of them over the years, you know, but I was second with 4. I got one for Murphy's America. I got an award for Murphy's Australia. I got one for Morning Call. I did Morning Call on radio for about 7 years.
Yeah.
the early morning program, and then I got another one for the live mic. So I got four in all, and it was great to get the four of them. I must say, I always kind of thought, yeah, it's just nice to get these things.
And you mentioned the live mic, but you also presented your own program called The Likes of Mike, if I'm not mistaken, in the earlier years.
Yeah.
is that where your version of Candid Camera, did you call them Murphy's Golden Movies?
MGM.
Yes.
Yeah, we called them MGM. The Likes of Mike was the first series I got. And out of the time I did the National Song Contest, Tom McGrath said to me, look, we might see if we can do your own series.
Right.
So he produced the first couple of series of The Likes of Mike. And I was hammered. I mean, I received what is euphemistically called mixed critical acclaim.
Right.
I was hammered by the critics. I remember Kevin Marin, God rest him. Kevin was the guy in the Sunday World at the time. The Sunday World was a new newspaper.
Oh, yes, yes.
He used to give it 2 pages. He'd do 2 pages slagging me. This man shouldn't be allowed on TV. He really went to town on me. But subsequently, he and I became great, great friends.
Right.
Tom McGrath had said to me at the very beginning of my career, and it was really wise, he said to me, I'm going to tell you one thing now, he said, never react to criticism.
Okay.
Don't let them know that you're hurt. Remember this, he said, for every newspaper there is in the country, you have at least 10 times the amount of viewers / readers that they have.
Right.
So he said, it's not going to matter what they say about you at all. It's only how you do on TV. And the ratings were always really good on TV, but Tom was right. And ever since, I never, ever reacted to any criticism in the newspapers.
It must be difficult to stay quiet.
Yeah, sometimes you read something about yourself and you do get annoyed. Mm. You know, there's no doubt about it, you do. I had a feud, as it was known, through the years with a very well-known Irish writer. He used to come in to me before he became the star writer. He used to come in to me on the art show. I think it might have been anyway on some program he came in to me. He was a regular contributor. And then an article appeared in McGill magazine, which was the most savage article I had ever read about myself.
Oh, wow.
Or indeed about anybody else. It was a savage article about me. It was signed by somebody I didn't know who the writer was. And then about 6 months later, my producer, Colin Morrison, said to me, Mike, I'm amazed that you're still talking to, and I won't name who it was, after what he wrote about you. And I said, what did he write about me? And he said, he wrote that article. I said, under a pseudonym. He said, yeah. Whoa. Well, I said, right. And I remember I was at the Gaiety Theatre a few nights later, and the writer and Fintan O'Toole of the Irish Times,
yes,
they stepped out into the aisle to go something, and I crooked my finger at him, and I said, come here, you. I said, I believe you're the one who wrote that article. He said, do you know how I regard you? I said, do you ever remember the school sneak?
Yeah.
I said, that's you. And I said, I think it is. I said, it's not the fact what you wrote. I said, that you wrote it under a pseudonym. You are repulsive. Mm-hmm. I said, one other thing. You will never be in a recording studio over which I have any control ever again in the future.
Wow.
And so Fintan O'Toole, I remember Fintan later years, he said, I'll never forget it. He said, I had never heard anybody speak that to anybody. He said, did I enjoy it? He said, I loved it. It was fantastic. I was privileged to be there, Fintan said. And right enough, that particular writer never did come into any studio.
Wow.
I said, I'm never, ever going to interview him again. Just on the basis of not what he wrote, but the fact that he did it so sneakily. But anyway, there you go. It's funny, isn't it? But we made it up years later, by the way. We made up publicly.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. If I can stay with television, Mike, just for a few minutes, and let's go back to the MGM, the Murphy's Golden Movies. These were inspired. They were candid camera type things, but they were so brilliant. You know, somebody having a knock at her door and a long lost nephew arriving and she not knowing who he is. And then you actually convinced her to let you in and let you stay. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
It must have been phenomenal. You must have had great fun, did you?
Well, we did, but there was a lot of pressure too, Jerry, you know, because we were, these days, you've got microphones, hidden microphones,
yeah.
You know, you've got hidden cameras, you can go inside into places. At that time, we went around to people's houses, we had the whole thing in an old van O'Brien's bread van with a hole cut in the O where the camera would stick out.
Okay.
You know, and I had a microphone, so I couldn't go in to the police people. I couldn't do any of that. So it all had to be on the doorstep.
Okay.
Either that or we had to do a major, major setup. But the doorstep things were funny. But we were under pressure because you're saying, hope to God this works. Because you only had the crew for the afternoon or something like that.
Yes.
And you're taking the chance. I kind of found that I had the facility of being able to ad lib. And so I could take these things further. I remember I could go really cool while everything was getting hot around me. I'd find myself getting cooler and saying to myself, I wonder how far could I push this?
And you just keep pushing, yeah.
And keep pushing. And some of them, I remember the one you're talking about, Auntie Cathy, Don Mullingar. And I called and I said I was her long-lost nephew. And Mammy said I could stay.
That's right.
And then when I told her, I always thought it was very funny. I told her and she nearly passed on. And she said, come here to me. She said, do you know what you'll do now? Go down to number 49
right.
to Mrs. O'Reilly. She'll die with the fright.
I remember another one. You were dropping off washing to someone.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she took it. I just said, "Will you?" And I'll be back at 6. And she took the washing. Yeah, that's right. Look, I know these were innocent days. Yeah,
indeed. Days. And one of the people that we came to love over the years was the late Dermot Morgan. And we know Dermot, I suppose, globally as Father Ted, but he was known in Ireland as many other things, but as Father Trendy. And as I think he was a school teacher at the time and he was trying to break into comedy, and you gave him a role or a spot on the live mic, and he used to stand up and as Father Trendy, and he used to criticise things that were going on. And that's where it started for him, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I was on Morning Call at the time doing the early morning radio. I used to get letters from people, and Dermot was an inveterate writer, and he'd send me these very funny letters, which I would read.
Yeah.
And he was a teacher in, I think it was St. Michael's, and myself and John Keogh, who's producer and friend of mine at the time, and John and I were commissioned by Muirish McAneely, who was the controller of programs. He called us in one day and he said, listen, you two, we've got the Late Late Show at that time was on Saturday night. And he said, listen, I want the two of you to go away. And he said, I want a big show for Friday nights.
Okay.
We're losing Fridays. I want a big show for Fridays. Now, you two, hightail it and come up with a formula. John and I went off and we kind of worked out what sort of formula will we do? And we worked on it. And then out of that, I said to John, and he knew of Dermot too, and we said, let's go and see what he's like. And he was doing a performance. He was doing a takeoff of Big Tom in UCD. And we went over and we saw him and we did think he was very funny. And that night we said to him, look, we're doing this program. Would you like to join us? And he said, yeah. And that was the start of Father Trendy. And it kind of took off from there. We had a great team. Twink was in it. I always was really proud. The live mic was a very strong format, and actually it ran for 4 years. And I didn't enjoy the fourth series. They were all gone.
Uh-huh.
All my team were gone.
Right.
They were all starting on their own. Twink, Dermot, all the producers. Because they were all good and they were all doing other things.
Yeah.
And I had a completely new team. I never told anybody, but on the very last night of the fourth series, we were still number one in the ratings. I said, well, that's it. I'm not coming back again next year. There was a general freak out in RTE.
You injected great fun into the stuff that you did on television. And is that kind of a part of your character, that kind of a divilment part of your character?
I often meet ex-colleagues of people who are backstage, camera people or stagehands and all that. And they always said, God, we had such fun working on all the programs. For me, it was very, very important that everybody involved in the program was having fun.
Hmm.
It was only a darn television program. There was nothing more to it, and I never thought of more than that. And I wanted to make sure, both on radio and TV, that whatever we're doing, let's make it fun. And I always injected fun into it. I never took it all too seriously, and it rubbed off. I genuinely wanted it to be fun. And also, to be perfectly frank with you, I wasn't that pushed. I was kind of more keen. The things I was doing really were more to fulfill my own life rather than to do great broadcasting. So that's why I maintained that. But like I mentioned, the other broadcasters, I reckon that they had a talent for broadcasting. I had a facility. I was able to turn my hands to doing things that I wanted to do in my own life, like going to America, like going to Australia, like doing a bit of satire. And then I eventually got into the arts. you know, in the art show.
That's right.
So I was doing all the things that I wanted to do through broadcast.
All right. Can I talk to you about your radio career? Because you mentioned a couple of times there, Morning Call. And if memory serves, it was Valerie McGovern was your co-host on that. That was the precursor to Morning Ireland. I mean, that's the flagship programme on RTE1 now. But the breakfast programme on any radio station is the key programme. How did you land into radio, Mike?
The morning radio, yeah. You mean? Well, I was doing other programmes. And by the way, no, Valerie was never my co-presenter.
What was she not?
Valerie actually presented it before I did.
Oh, okay.
I took it over. I think I took it over from Valerie, as far as I recall.
Right.
It turned out to be great fun. Yeah, so I did it on my own. I did it for 7 years. It was tough going because of the early mornings.
Yeah.
But Gene Martin was my producer, and Gene was older than me, but we had such fun together. He was a divil. He was totally anti the establishment in RTE.
Right.
He introduced me to art, so the painting and the art. He and I were divils, you know, we were kind of renowned in RT as divils. And as soon as we finished, at about 9:30 or whatever time we finished, we'd head off down to the Magnet Pier Street for a couple of hot biscuits and a cheese sandwich.
and then we
go over on the art galleries, you know. I mean,
okay.
There was a time, but Gene was a divil. And I remember we just had fun. And all the people who used to work with us on the early morning loved working on it because we were kind of, at that time you'd use the word bold, doing nasty things, you know.
Yes.
I remember there was one of the weathermen, Gene couldn't stand one of the guys on the weather. From our studio, you could control whatever was going out on the air.
Okay.
And Gene found this little clip of a belch, a person belching.
Right.
When the weatherman would take a pause, Gene would stick in the belch. And it would go out. It would go out all over the nation.
People just assume it was him.
God, your man is dreadful, isn't he? The way he's belching on the air.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. Well, so we were into all that kind of stuff. So it passed the time for us. We had great fun doing it.
And you had a yowza, yowza, yowza. Was that you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was great because any records we didn't like, poor old Big Tom. And Big Tom was such a lovely man. But Tom used to get the yowza yowza. We'd play Gentle Mother and go yowza yowza, because brutal, you know, kind of thing. And we'd play another, some of these American, Old Shep, I remember, was another one about a dog dying.
Yes.
I think he saved the planet before he died or something. And we'd give it the yowza yowza. Any records we didn't like, we'd give it the yowza yowza yowza.
Love it.
Yeah.
I'm coming close to the end of the historic broadcasting, and we'll talk to you about what you're doing now very shortly. But can I ask you about the arts show? And you said there that Gene had given you a great love of the arts, and maybe that's where it was instilled. But you went on to present the arts show on RTE Radio.
I was doing an afternoon program, I was doing an evening program, I was doing a lunchtime program, and as I remember saying to the controller programs at the time, look, I've run out of cliches. I'm kind of done. I'm bored doing it. I kind of was saying, what the heck am I going to do now? Because I really was just getting bored. And I figured, if I'm getting bored, then the listeners are getting even more bored. So then the controller program said to me, look, and he spoke to another producer, and he said, look, you're interested in the arts. Would you be interested in doing an arts program? So I said, God, that'd be very interesting. And I said, gee, wait, hold on. Am I going to be at a very grave disadvantage here? And then I rationalized and I said, okay, I don't know much about classical music. I don't know much about opera. But I do go to the movies all the time. I do listen to music, popular music. Mm-hmm. I do read voraciously. And I know a good bit about Irish art and international art. So I said, well, I'm going to give it a go. So I went into it on the basis that, look, I was wanted to give people the understanding that I'm learning as much as the listeners are by interviewing a John Banville or whoever else.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of took the approach, look, I'm going to be asking stupid questions, but there'll be questions that a lot of people might feel they would like to ask too. And the years went by and it became quite popular. The art show became quite popular and RTE moved it from the evening slot, which was a 7 o'clock slot, to an afternoon slot, and it gained more popularity. And for the arts community, it was a fantastic boost because it was like a vote of confidence in the arts in general, to have them on RTE1 in mainstream radio. So it was a fantastic shop window for the arts and for artists, musicians, the painters, sculptors in general, and writers. And we gave poetry a great bit of a lift as well. Again, though, I didn't understand, so I'd say, look, I don't get it, but tell it anyway.
Yeah.
And people wanted, to be honest, I remember Seamus Heaney used to be fantastic. Seamus, anytime we wanted Seamus to come on, he loved being on the art show. You know, most of the people who were distinguished art people were very pleased to be on the program. And of course, I loved meeting them and talking to them and asking them what did you mean by and what's it about, etc. So it was great. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
That's brilliant. Can I talk to you about your singing and your dancing career?
No, you cannot.
Really?
No, I refuse to talk about it. I'm embarrassed enough. I'm embarrassed enough that you even remember either my singing or my dancing. So you cannot talk to me about it. I'd rather forget it. It gives me a headache. I go all week and nauseous when I think about it.
I watched something online about putting together You'll Get By If You Give It A Try, which ripped the Irish charts apart in 1977, and it was fascinating to watch it. Again, it was just fun, wasn't it?
Of course it was. We were doing a thing where I was trying different things, and one of the things we said, well, let's see if we can make a record, and You'll Get By If You Give It A Try. Sean Davey wrote.
Yeah.
All my pals from the music world, Anne Bushnell and John Kern and Des Smith and Sonny Knowles, they all joined in as the chorus.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we recorded. And do you know something? I think it became, it got into the Irish charts.
It did.
I don't know where the hell it. It got into the Irish charts and did quite well.
Mm.
And actually, it turned out to be quite a nice tune. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, okay, so I don't feel that embarrassed about that particular one. There are lots of other experiences I had where I do feel embarrassed.
There was one. There was one other that I found.
Yeah, I knew you were going to bring something up. Yeah, right.
No. There was one I found which was broadcast on the 25th of March, 1983, where you did a duet with Frankie Vaughan. Yeah. Yeah, you did. Hello, Dolly.
I didn't know. Did I really? Yeah. I have no recollection of that.
Oh, really?
A funny thing, somebody else said to me, I saw you on TV doing a duet with Max Bygraves.
Wow.
And I have no recollection of ever meeting Max Bygraves. A funny thing, I remember Gay and I, as you probably know, were very close friends.
Yeah.
And I remember we were away somewhere. We were listening to music. We were abroad somewhere. And Gay said, oh, that's Roy Orbison. God, I always loved Roy Orbison. You know something? He's somebody I'd love to have met. And Kathleen said, you interviewed him twice. He said, did I? I'm like, I'm the same about that. I have no recollection of doing anything with Frankie Vaughan.
Well,
like I say, somebody said you did one with Max Bygraves as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I never want to see or hear them, by the way. But I'm kind of, yeah, it's interesting that I did meet them.
Yeah, if anybody wants to just Google Mike Murphy singing.
No, don't, sorry, I'd prefer you didn't give them any clues.
Right, let's talk about, that's a lot about the past. And Mike, thank you for sharing those thoughts with me and those memories. And it's lovely to get them from, as you will say, the horse's mouth. The podcast that you are involved with at the moment, it all started out by a phone call from the nice people at the Senior Times. Now, the Senior Times is a publication. It's a magazine that's distributed in Ireland. And they also organize over 50 events like expos. And I know that in Spain, the expats living on the Costa del Sol, they go along to the expat show at the Hotel IPV in Fuengirola on an annual basis. You got a telephone call to know, would you be interested in getting involved in a podcast? And you jumped at it. And what do you know about podcasts, Mike?
Absolutely nothing, and I still don't.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is, yeah, but I thought that Des Duggan from Senior Times contacted me. And they had done an interview with me, I think, aboard the magazine. And I was kind of interested in the magazine because I thought, you know, that's a darn good magazine to have out. And particularly for a segment of the population that is growing. You know, I mean, us old timers, there are more and more of us. The Senior Times are operating on the basis that their public begins at age 50. So they're not talking about kind of old fogies like myself. They're talking about people from the age of 50 who would be considering kind of pension, retirement, things like that.
Yeah.
And entertainment and what to do when you are retired and how to fill in your time and interesting things to do. And I just thought, now that does appeal to me. The very idea of the magazine and I have never done a podcast. I know nothing about podcasts, really.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, I'd be interested in doing that. And I said, for something new. And again, just tweaked my interest. And I said, yeah, I'd be very interested in doing that. So that's how it started. And that's how we went about it.
And did you have an input as to who you would interview, or were the was Des?
Oh God, yeah. No, I did, and okay. In fact, I was kind of instrumental in saying, look, the following people are, I think, would be people who would be very interesting to speak to, and I'd be able to contact them, because I'm in the fortunate position that because I was well known at one stage and all that. A lot of people would take my phone calls and say, yeah, if you're interested in doing an interview with me, I'll do it. So everybody I asked said yes.
Okay.
So it was quite nice, you know.
And the first podcast has been released, and the first person on the list was Uachtaráin na hÉireann, Michael D. Higgins, and that has been released. Why did you want Uachtaráin na hÉireann?
Two reasons. One, to start with the president of the country is not a bad beginning, I kind of figured. But two, I'm a great admirer of Michael Higgins, and I have been for many years. He's an extraordinary thinker. I think he's an extraordinary politician. I think he's just an extraordinary man. He's an artist. He's a poet. He's a philosopher. He has so many strings to his bow. And what I did not want to interview him on being president and on his thoughts about the world and where we're going and so on. But I knew that he had a difficult enough childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, I am going to concentrate only on his childhood, because Michael D. Higgins comes across as precisely what I described just over the last couple of minutes. Mm. He comes across as a highly sophisticated, you would say, high-class background or upper-class background, elitist almost, so articulate, so highly educated. He must be from a gifted landed family, perhaps, with all these things. He gives the impression of being a highly intellectualized man. But I knew that his background was completely different.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, now I would like to be able to concentrate on his childhood. Now, two things. One, he's a very difficult man to keep on track, because he'd be chatting away to you, maybe about his childhood, and he'd say, I'm reminded of the time I was in the Crimea, and so he's off on another tangent. So difficult to keep him on one. But two, his advisors, Elk Norris and Uachtaráin, said, look, he doesn't really want to talk about his childhood, and he'd rather not read any poetry. So I decided, well, I'll deal with the childhood, I'll get him to read a bit of poetry.
Right.
So he was very amenable. And I said to him before we started, look, I'm going to concentrate on your childhood. I hope it's okay with you. He said, well, okay. So we did. I listened back to it myself, and I thought, that really is interesting. It's a very interesting look at an Ireland that is no longer with us. And he had a difficult childhood, and he overcame so much to become president of Ireland. He's had a difficult life. He had hard times for his parents. He describes it all, hard times for himself.
Yes.
Separated from his parents for many, many years. And he's a man who knows his farming. He can milk a cow, he can plow a field, he can do this, that. He, you know, just extraordinary. And I was really glad we had decided to interview him as the first, because I was quite pleased with the interview. And there's no doubt there's a very good reaction to it. I'm getting I don't know much about podcasts, but there is a good reaction, and he is worth listening to.
He absolutely is. Did you know him through the arts program, or did you know him in other ways prior to this?
I do indeed. I know him through the arts program, really. I mean, he was in many times reading his poetry, and we get on very well together. You know, I remember we were at a rugby match there, one of the Leinster matches last year. He was the guest of honour. As it happened, my cousin was the president of the Leinster Rugby Union, and he invited me. And the guest of honour was the president. Well, Michael D. was thrilled to see me there, and I was to see him, and we spent the whole match together. And my cousin said, thank God you were there. I didn't know what to talk to him about. I wouldn't have known what to say to him. So I'm very fond of him as a man, and I admire him.
Did you learn something new about him in the interview?
You can rein him in if you're straight.
Oh, okay. can rein him, okay.
But other than that, because I had poor gaze, the big late show where Michael D. was on with Ryan at the very beginning of the program, where poor gaze, you know, we were all remembering.
Yes.
And Michael D went on and on, and I was saying to myself, Brian, you need to be able to say thank you very much, Hooper, on the air.
Yeah, because you all wanted to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Now,
yeah.
I know that as we talk today, much of the country is indoors and much of the world is indoors because of the COVID-19 outbreak. But some of these podcasts have been recorded already. Who have you in the can?
Yeah, we have. We've recorded 6 of them. Mary Louise O'Donnell, we've recorded John McColgan. Interesting about John, I interviewed John before they were about to launch their 25th anniversary.
This is Riverdance.
Tour, and John, and they were about to launch it. And of course, we were talking about, isn't it fantastic, the 25 years, and then all of that, and then now it's been cancelled.
Absolutely.
The big tour. So I actually phoned John yesterday and I said, John, we may have to re-record part of the opening,
yes,
because I said it's no longer relevant, so we'll have to do that. So I recorded John, we recorded Terry Prone, Deirdre Purcell, Dennis O'Brien. Dennis talked very freely. Dennis, I'm very fond of Dennis. I got involved in Palestine. I'm very anti what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians, and I went public on it. And I think I'm blackballed in visiting Israel or Palestine again. But yeah, but Dennis's family liked what I was doing, and Dennis's mother was so impressed by it that she put a huge amount of money into a hospital in Gaza.
Wow.
As a result of my getting involved. So Dennis was delighted to do the interview with me, although he said, I'm not doing any more damn interviews. And he did a super interview, really good. It'll be out in one of these.
Yeah.
So that's it, yeah. So I think we had Ryan, I think, was going to do one, and Marty Morrissey, but they're had to shelve them now and do after the crisis.
Right. I suppose right now, as people are indoors quite a lot, or here in Ireland, at least we can get out and about and we can go for a walk. Are you hoping that people will put that on their device and take it with them or listen to it at home as they're relaxing? The audience, I suppose, needs to be aware and to grow on it, doesn't it?
To be honest with you, I'm delighted to have the opportunity of having this chat with you, because just to let people know that it's there, that's... And also, you see, it's the kind of thing with the podcast. The nice thing is you can stick it on. It's easy to access. Go to seniortimes.ie and you should be able to access it through that. It's also on iTunes, I gather. I think it's iTunes. But seniortimes.ie. And then you can get it. But the good thing is, I mean, you can leave it on or switch it off and pick it up later on. But you're right. But unfortunately, we're all stuck indoors nowadays. I think it's quite nice to have something like that of interest to listen to. It just passes the time, you know.
And yeah.
Michael D is the president of the country, and a lot of people don't really know a lot about his background. And it just introduces something new about him. So I'd love people to listen to it and maybe derive a bit of pleasure, or at least get something interesting out of it. So yeah, the more the merrier. Incidentally, you mentioned Spain there. We were in Spain a couple of weeks ago, and I'll tell you something. It's rough over there. We got notification. You can only go 50 meters from your dwelling and this kind of stuff. It is tough for people in Spain. Now, we're able at least to go out for a walk, which is what we do every day.
Yeah.
But boy, in Spain, they're having it hard. They really are.
Yeah, and I suppose we were talking a little earlier on, and we said that at least here we can go for a walk. But if the weather changes and it starts to rain like it does so much, that's where a lot of people are going to be really tested. And likewise in Spain, I mean, people have their balcony. They live on their balconies anyway a lot of the times. But it is tough to be corralled in the house with the family for a very extended period of time.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. It is tough. Let's hope it's not going to be for too much longer.
No. I know you've been hugely generous with your time, Mike. Thank you very much indeed. Before I go, can I just ask you just for an opinion, because the radio business particularly is changing and has been doing so over the last 10 or 15 years. And this thing with COVID-19, people are starting to do a lot more work online and Facebook time and all that kind of stuff. Do you think that it's going to further change how we get information, how we are entertained? Do you see that this has been kind of rushed now with this new development?
I do think, in terms of national stations, like in Ireland, RTE, and in Britain, BBC, I do think that we will always call upon them, I believe, in times of crisis.
Yeah.
I believe we will tune in to national stations for reassurance and information. I do believe it. So once you tune in, as you know, once you tune into a station, you tend to stay with the station. Mm. So I would be kind of worried if I was even in RT or BBC or wherever, because, you know, people are going to say, I'm going to try and find some other amusement for myself because I don't want to be involved too much. I think people are going to start learning about podcasts. And the more they learn about podcasts, the more they learn about other forms of in-house entertainment, the more they'll stick with the new formulae. And I would be fearful, I really hope it doesn't happen, but that some of the smaller radio stations, that they may suffer on the back of our being confined as we are. And we're being really forced to find other sources of entertainment. No question about that, we are. Mm. And other sources of entertainment will emerge. And as they do, they will be a challenge to the establishment. So, yes, I would be fearful, but you do not want to see people losing their jobs. You don't want to see local radio stations, for example, losing their impetus, their relevance to the local community. So it's a time of change. It's a time of flux. And there's no doubt, I do think that the world we have lived in is going to be very different in the future.
Indeed. Mike, Ken, I wish you well with the Senior Times podcasts, and hopefully it won't be long before you can be back recording with those again. Wish you well with your travels, and can I say a big thank you? You've been hugely generous with your time. I really appreciate it. It's been fantastic to talk to you. I'm glad that you're sounding so well and that you're keeping well, and keep it that way, and we'll chat to you again hopefully sometime in the future.
Okay, Ger, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Live on Air, presented by Ger Sweeney.
Welcome to the final part of the programme. Let us go to Ben Sweeney and find out what things are like in Ireland at the moment in relation to COVID-19. Ben is the producer of Morning Focus on Clare FM. Ben, good to talk to you as always. How are you?
Hi, Ger. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And we'll come back to health issues in just a minute. But since we spoke last week, Leo Varadkar, our Taoiseach, has been on the television again on Friday evening. And Ireland is virtually in a lockdown situation or scenario, even though he doesn't like to use that word. But we've been told basically to stay inside, aren't we?
Yeah, you're right there. He doesn't like the use of the word lockdown. As you've said, we're still allowed to leave the house. There's a relatively long list of essential services that are allowed to still operate. People can go within 2 kilometres of their house for exercise. They are being told to kind of curb any non-essential travel. And for the most part, people seem to be adhering to that. I mean, there's photos on social media of motorways, of you know, cities at 8 o'clock on Saturday night, and they're essential ghost towns. So people are adhering to it. You know, we discussed last week what the next move is going to be because we were anticipating some sort of announcement last Tuesday. But I suppose the announcement on Friday kind of came in as a bit of a surprise. We hadn't expected things to be ramped up so quickly, but again, it did come from the guidance that the National Emergency Response Team have been making, and they've been very good to adhere to any recommendations that the health experts are making. But yeah, essentially, for all intents and purposes, really, Ireland is under lockdown, and it does seem to be working in slowing things down. I've seen social media posts with statistics of maybe the last 10 days of cases that have been confirmed, and how there hasn't been a dramatic spike. Particularly, it's been kind of a slow and steady increase, and people are saying, well, look, that's a sign that this is starting to work.
On that very thing, Ben, and I know that you don't mind us talking about this, but last week's insert that you did for the programme, we pre-recorded it, and halfway through you had to leave, even though nobody knew that. And the reason that we pre-recorded it and you had to leave was because you had symptoms and you had the testers called to your door midway through the interview and you left. Now, that was last Monday at lunchtime, and you haven't received your results of that test as yet. So you basically have been isolating in your bedroom for the last 7 days, and you feel well, and you don't know whether you had it, whether you have it, or whether you don't.
It's a thing we've seen a lot of complaining done about. Originally, the testing was 3 or 4 days before you might get a result. Now it looks as if it's a week plus. I know I said to you off air that I'd heard 9 days floated last Monday, and I was kind of hoping it wouldn't be that. But I suppose the reality, what they're saying about the delay in test results coming back, is act as if you have it either way, and there won't be a problem. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's an inconvenience for me and for other people. There's thousands across the island who are self-isolating, if not tens of thousands, that might be waiting for results. But what they're saying is, well, you know, you're doing what you would be doing if you have it anyways. And so long as you can get on and do your work and everything while you're self-isolating, then look, it's a small price to pay to make sure that you're safe and make sure everyone else is safe. I suppose they're hoping that the more it goes on, they can try and get tests out quicker. They've expanded their testing facilities, and hospitals are now doing it, but it's primarily for frontline staff so they can get the results for them quicker. But what they've also done is they've changed the criteria for how people are eligible for testing. So now you have to have a confirmed case, or you've been in contact with a confirmed case, or travel to a region, you also have to have a number of the main symptoms, not perhaps one. They're hoping that changing the criteria for testing will remove a lot of people from that list. But even if you are showing symptoms, they're still saying, play it safe and self-isolate.
But if they do manage to get those tests done and confirmed, or maybe with negative results, those numbers that we got in the last 24 hours, now in about an hour's time or within the next hour, we'll hear what today's figure is. But right now, as of last night, the figure was 3,025 people confirmed on the island of Ireland with COVID-19 and 67 deaths in that on the island. So I suppose you can expect that there will be a spike in that number, those numbers indeed, over the next wee while when testing results come back.
First of all, last week we would have been discussing how I think it's 6% is the return rate that have tested positive. But we're hearing today and a bit yesterday as well that they're expecting now a peak maybe in mid-April, between the 10th and 14th of April. And they're saying when that happens, there could be 546 people a day who need intensive care. Right, yeah. At the moment, we're looking at about 45. So in the space of, you know, 2 weeks, how we're going to jump to 546 people when we're supposed to be self-isolating and they're saying it's working, you'd have to imagine that's going to come down to the testing, like you're saying there, that we are going to see a big spike.
There was a lot of talk last week about the lack of, or the shortage of, PPE, which is the personal protection equipment used by healthcare workers. But yesterday, the first consignment came from China, and that is certainly going to have an impact. And we know that there are 10 more flights due between now and Wednesday evening. So that's a good thing.
It certainly is. And I mean, there's been a lot of good publicity for the national, or the flag bearer of the planes, Aer Lingus, who flew that flight. Certainly very important. I mean, I think they've gone through an entire, I think it's 15 years worth of PPE I saw today. They're going to be recovering in the space of a month. So fairly substantial and very much needed to the case, and very much a logic that, well, you know, we can do what we can here, but we're going to need our neighbours and the rest of the countries to row in and help each other here.
And speaking of that, Ben, finally, talking about the support that we need, particularly at a time of bereavement in Ireland, we're very good at rallying around those who are bereaved. And I see the two dioceses in particular in Ireland yesterday has said, look, lads, I'm sorry, we can't do any more funerals. It's just not worth the risk to everybody. So now people who die, whether it's coronavirus related or not, are being brought straight to the graveyard. There will be a very small ceremony. And then if people want to have a mass said for their loved ones who have passed away, that can be done when this is all cleared up. So that is going to have an impact, and it's going to further isolate people and further enhance grief when people go through bereavement, won't it?
It certainly will. And, you know, not working in a newsroom, you know, this idea of death notices that get rung in by undertakers. This is something they've been telling us is going to happen for maybe a month or so now. Right. As you say there is a huge tradition around funerals and mourning that Ireland has, and Ireland manages very well. But it is kind of an essential part of grieving for us here. The fact that that's gone now is going to be very distressing to people. You know, they already don't have their religious services. They were cut maybe a month or so ago now, but that they don't have a way to properly grieve for someone is something that's very new. And people probably won't be able to get their head around. For a lot of people, it's not only that, but they also probably haven't seen him since the ambulance took them away. If it is a coronavirus-related issue, I've heard a lot of stories on social media of people who their wife was taken away by ambulance showing mild symptoms and unfortunately passed away, and they never got to see them again before they, you know, there was a headstone put up for them. So it's a very upsetting time. You know, we talk about how upsetting it is to not be able to leave the house, or and frustrating it is that you get cooped up, but then you see that side of it. It's a very upsetting time for pretty much everyone involved.
All right, Ben, we're going to leave it there because the clock has beaten us. Fingers crossed that the test results will be back soon and that they will be negative and that you'll be able to get out of the room in which you're cocooned at the minute and back to work. So fingers crossed on that. Thanks for joining us today. Look after yourself and hopefully see you soon from a distance.
That's great. Thanks, sir.
That's Ben Sweeney, who is the producer of Morning Focus on Clare FM, giving us an update on what's happening in Ireland at the moment. And that is where I am going to leave it for this evening. Can I say a big thank you for tuning in to the programme? I hope that you enjoyed it. A little bit different today with the extended interview. Thank you very much to Mike Murphy once again. Thank you to Ben. And a big thank you to our Spanish-Irish cultural advisor, Jose Antonio Sierra. Look after yourselves in the coming week. Stay at home. Most importantly, look after yourselves and each other if you can. From me, Ger Sweeney. Until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.